Anna will read the preamble.
Hi, everyone. I'm Anya, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they can may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join me in a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Connie will read the steps.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Connie, and I'm an alcoholic. The steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Jeff will read the traditions.
My name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of the meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Cassandra.
Up she goes. Hi, I'm Cassandra. I'm an alcoholic. I am so grateful for the opportunity to speak to my home group. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you for... the opportunity just to, this is one of my final Tuesday meetings before I go to California to pursue something that I remember when I first came in, somebody said, "Do you have any hobbies?" And I was like, "Well, no." Like, you know. And I'll have 3 years sobriety this coming Friday, God willing. The last thing I thought that this program was going to give me was, an identity. And a lot of times we're like, be selfless. But one of my favorite promises is to thine own self be true. I was too scared to even admit the things that I actually liked. And through a gift of this program, the more I give myself, the more I'm able to find. So how I got here. I started drinking really, really young. Really young at 13. I guess it's not young. Some of you people get sober at 13, but I started at 13. It was young for me. And it was fast. It was really fast. And from 13 to 26, when I did come to AA, I had a lot of self-talk, I think, and I was like, I think at 15 I would have been like, I'm ready, let's go to AA, I am an alcoholic, I was kicked out of school, and I was an honor student before, like it was really, really quick, but there was a lot of controlled drinking in my story, so if that's your situation, if you were able to have a couple nights that you only had 3 or 4, man, I held on to those, like, as evidence that I was an alcoholic. And so by the time I got sober at 26, it took a lot. I really had to take that first step. I really had to get down to the details of my story and how powerless I was over alcohol. I'll just say, I used alcohol to be excited. I used alcohol... I basically had like 3 emotions. Like I was like either really excited about like getting drunk or like going out, like that surge that you felt before you went out with your friends. Like tonight's going to be amazing. And, everything's just going to this one time in college, I was in a dance troupe and, which really just meant that we put on crazy outfits and went to see our friend's band play and get kicked out of clubs. and so my friend was like, let's get dressed up. And so she was like, let's blow their minds and put on adult diapers. And and so I did that, and we did it, and I'm not going to get into the detail, and... This was towards the end of my drinking, and I remember I was going to blow some guy's mind, and he was going to be like, "You are awesome! Like this is the best dance." I don't know, but I just remember him not being there, finishing the performance, and him not being there, and then the devastation. And I am really bad at disappointment. I'm still bad with disappointment, I was never disappointed for long. I was just, and the next thing I remember is I woke up in an Eckerd's parking lot, like all the car windows were open, and I had like fried cheese in my hair, and I was in the adult diaper, and it was horrible. I had no idea how to process an emotion. And what I realized today and what AA has taught me is that when I sit through that stuff, that's how I learn as a human being, and that's how I'm able to learn, like how I'm able to grow. And I didn't c- come in for that. Like, I came in to be, just because I kind of, like, overshot, you know? I thought I just was going to, like, learn some tips and tricks on how to quit drinking. And just hold on really tight like I had been, you know? And I was having DTs every morning, and then I was having a seizure, but I still wasn't, this disease is so insidious, like I still wasn't willing to accept that I was an alcoholic. And they didn't let me board a flight. I had a seizure, and right in front of like the security, and she was like, "You're not getting on this plane." And I was just like, "I'm okay." And I just remember her like digging her hand, like this was my moment of clarity. She just like dug her nails into my arm, and she's like, "You're not okay." And I was like, "I am not okay." Like, and I was, "Can we talk now?" I knew who to call. Somebody had been making suggestions about going to meetings, and I knew exactly who to call, and I went to a 7:30 in the morning meeting, and it was in Soho. I lived in Brooklyn. It was totally inconvenient, but I just remember I walked in, and I just remember this guy said, he said, "I had this attitude problem of like, I walked down the street with like, don't you know who I think I am?" And I was like, yes. I was like, and that's what AA too is, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you learn all this like language. And I was like, resentment, that I have a resentment, this is amazing. Like, I was wondering what this feeling was. And so when I say that I first got into the rooms, like group of drunks, that was my first higher power. You know, those meetings were I kept going. And 8 months in, the meeting stopped working, or I was ready to, you know, find a sponsor and do the work. And I followed somebody who had what I wanted. She said she came here. And I saw a fur coat or something, and I was like, "I'm leaving. Like, this is not..." God's grace, like, I grabbed somebody, and I knew her from another meeting, and she was just like, you know, "Sit down," and we went through the steps, and I did step one, and I felt horrible. I was like, "My life is horrible," and then I took step two, and when I say that it changed my life, like, it was the first time that I was able to sit through that discomfort, you know, the first time I was ever just to have that really simple idea of, like, it's gonna be okay. It doesn't get a lot more complicated for me in my faith today. Like, it's just going to be okay. I did a lot of house clean A work steps, 4 through 9. I didn't really understand. If you don't really understand, I love what Clancy says. Like, if you don't understand what you're doing, I was making amends, going to Texas, going to Seattle, like, you know, and just, I didn't understand what happened, but it's really like our, you know, why I was doing it, but, you know, it really, really, my sponsor just spoke up here, we don't know what this stuff is doing for other people, and I love that idea, like, I was making amends, and I had no idea what I was doing, and that all that pain and all that stuff that I didn't understand the first 26 years of my life was worth something today, and that's huge for me, like, that it's just so... it's kind of, sometimes I have bad days, and that's enough. I can just like hit my pillow and go safe, you know. I help somebody else, and that's the promise of the 12th step, you know, like, to that we get to be useful. And I worked the first 11 steps with a sponsor, and she left. But I hooked up with my sponsor that I have today, and it was right at the 12th step, and she really taught me about getting out of myself. I still didn't quite get it. I thought it was still kind of to go to, like, meetings and say really profound stuff, like, or say really good stuff to the newcomers and make sure you hurt, you know, but just the constant working with others over and over again and just really learning the humility that, you know, I'm doing this for my sobriety and I can only share with you, like, my experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, Elizabeth has constantly just, like, turned my gaze outward and just made me feel like a useful, you know, a useful human being. And like I said, I mean, I never could figure out, like, what I was like. I've made my higher power, you know, my profession. That's my story, you know, so many times. And And I was just waiting to read the right self-help book, do something, like a lot of self-searching, read something. And like I said, I mean, it was only by like continuously like thinking of others and like only by like self-forgetting do I truly find. And now I'm just so excited about my new life that I'm about to embark on. And I'm just so grateful for all of you. Faye said it so eloquently, just like could go through each pew and just thank so many of you. I've been on the receiving end of so much grace and love from this group. And I'm going to miss you guys. Bye.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Kevin.
Hello, my name is Kevin, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's really nerve-wracking to be honest. If I was telling you something that was untruthful, I would have a really easy time up here. But being honest is difficult, and it's been one of the keys to my sobriety. The reason I'm an alcoholic is that when I take a drink, I have little control over how much I'll take or how long I'll take. I just want more, and more is never enough. So, that being said, a story that I want to tell you is when I was a little kid, my first real addiction was to cereal, sugary cereals, kind with a little marshmallows, dehydrated marshmallows in it. I used to go shopping with my mother. I wasn't allowed to have these cereals. I would go to the store with her. She'd be pushing the cart. She would go find some product, and I would run to the sugary cereal aisle, pick what I wanted, dig it underneath, you know, the other items, and when she was at the cash register, I'd occupy her so she wouldn't see it going through. I would spot which bag it went into, and when we parked the car, she would take a bag in, and as she was coming out, I would take the bag that had the cereal in it. I would run in, pull up the cereal, go upstairs, put it in my closet, come back down, and pretend like nothing happened. And then at midnight, I would speak into the microphone. I would very quietly come down the stairs, and I would, with my cereal box, pour a bowl of cereal for myself and eat it quietly in front of the TV. And that felt like incredible for me. It was like a wonderful moment where I was at peace with the world. And it's really how I drank. It's how I drank. I was such a sneaky, sneaky drinker. I was a sneaky person. And I, the honesty is what combats that sneakiness now today. You know, one of the things that I did, you know, in the end of my drinking, I was in a relationship, loving relationship with this guy. I would wait for him to fall asleep, and I would crawl over him so I could, you know, he's a pretty heavy sleeper, so I would crawl over him so I could drink and do whatever I was going to do until late at night and try to pass out a few hours before he woke up so it looked like I was sleeping next to him all night. That's what I would do anything. I would do anything to stay high. If something felt good, I wanted it to stay forever. If something was horrible, I wanted to obliterate it. And, you know, and now I'm here. I'm a member of this group. I'm a member of the Atlantic group. My sponsor is Vince, right over here, who's been incredibly helpful to me and my sobriety over the past 5 years. And I worked the steps with him. We read the big book together, and I've, you know, had the privilege to be able to pass that on to other people. And that is a really cool thing, to feel useful. That my horribleness and what I thought was so despicable has become the things that have been the most useful and helpful in my life today. So there seems to be a bit of a theme. I, too, am leaving. I am moving to Honolulu, and I'm leaving in 11 days. And yes, still not comfortable doing that. But anyway, and I'm really excited a few weeks ago, these two people from Maui spoke that were former members of the Atlantic group. And so I got in contact with them. I have, you know, AA is everywhere. That's a really, really amazing thing that I love. And in my job, I worked as a professional dancer. And I've been able to go all over the world, and I've been able to go to meetings everywhere and be sober everywhere and be helped by people and help people. And it's pretty incredible. It's a good deal to be here. And if you're new, I was so freaked out. I was so scared. The only thing that I knew is that if I didn't do what I was being told to do, I was going to die. And I really believe that. And that fear kept me coming and kept me doing the work. And, you know, I'm here with you today. I guess a little bit about what's going on right now. You know, fear is like big time right now. Like the fact that I'm starting, I had surgery a few months ago on my knee, which made me have to stop dancing. I'm not sure if it's going to be forever or if it's going to at least be a year. And that was a big thing. I had to, you know, deal with pain medication. I had to be really honest about that. I had to keep a journal. I had to like talk to people in the program. Had to talk to my sponsor about that and got a lot of support and got through that. And I'm at the point now where I'm sober. I can do anything. And I got this really amazing opportunity to move to Hawaii and to be able to teach dance and to choreograph, which is something I really love to do. And it was a total higher power sequence of events that took place that is getting me to Hawaii. Knowing that, I'm still freaked out, you know? Like, my, like drinking and drugs, like, definitely part of my story. Those things allowed me to make decisions without thinking about things. I didn't have to feel anything. I just made rash, crazy decisions all the time. And sometimes they worked out, a lot of times they didn't, and I just didn't care because I just stayed high. So now I get the opportunity to make these decisions in sobriety and to make a conscious decision to move, to be able to wrap things up, to pass my sponsees on to other people, to be able to find out meetings and start to get a support network in place for me when I get there. You know, I want to get to a meeting the first day that I get there. This is the most important thing. Like, if I'm not sober, I feel really bad for Hawaii. You know, it's not going to be a good situation. So for me and for them, I will continue on this journey. I guess one thing I'd really like to talk about has been very helpful to me is sponsorship. And sponsorship has, I don't know, like I don't trust anyone. And my first step in getting to have a relationship with a power greater than myself was first building this trusting relationship with my sponsor. And being able to do that has taught me little by little to be able to expand that trust onto something bigger than I am. And I'm grateful for that. Like today I was able to pray with someone before coming up here. I never would have done that before. I'm able to sit and meditate, you know, and a lot of times I need to be reminded to do these things, and that's why I need a lot of support and a lot of help, and that's all available to me here. It takes a village to get someone sober, and you know, I'm an example of that. One thing that was helpful to me that I wanted to pass along to you, my sponsor gave this to me, and it's from Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking. There are these affirmations, these God affirmations, that I've used throughout this past 5 years. And the first one is, God is with me, God is helping me, God is guiding me, God loves me. The second is, with God, all things are possible. The next one has been really getting me through this time, which is be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid. With God before me, who could be against me? And with God, there's another one, I don't know what it is, I forget. That's enough, those are good. Be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid. And every time that I'm able to muster, like, that's maybe the wrong choice of words, muster the strength, because it's not me mustering strength. I'm opening myself up to the strength and power that is around me and works through me. When I'm able to do that and open up in that way, incredible things have happened. And, you know, the ability to be able to go and teach people what I love to do is incredible. And I can do that with dignity and with grace and great discipline because I'm sober and I know how to do that. I can show up. And I don't know. This, you know, it's a... I'm just grateful to be here. I'm grateful for my sobriety. I'm grateful for all of you who have helped me and who I've been able to help. And I'll be seeing you around. Bye.
Our main speaker tonight is Marita.
Hi, my name is Marita, and I'm an alcoholic. First, I want to thank Heidi. It is an incredible honor to share my experience, strength, and hope at the meeting that has become my beloved home group, the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Thea, who was a member of the Atlantic Group at the time. She became my sponsor, and then she circumstances took her to Seattle. And she has sponsored me for the past, I don't know, 3.5 years, I guess it is, from Seattle. I think she was my sponsor in New York for like 6 months. And my sobriety date is November 28, 1996. I am currently living in steps 10, 11, and 12 and making a lengthy ninth step financial restitution. I'm sorry, but I always have to take a minute. I meditate every day now, and this morning in my meditation, this thought just came to me that if I could just remember to pause before I speak, then the higher power could possibly get a word in edgewise, but if I didn't, that my ego would qualify. And my ego has been talking to me for weeks since Heidi asked me. It has a lot to say, and the thought that came to me was, just tell your ego it can speak next week. God's speaking tonight. You know that didn't come from me. At least I know that didn't come from me. And everything that I say that's of any use either came from the book, probably from someone in this room, or from the higher power. Of course, I discussed with Thea talking, and she said to speak to the person, as she always does, who is convinced that this is not going to work for her or him. I am particularly fond of speaking to newcomers and people who are trying to come back. I'm particularly fond of people who are trying to come back. It could be me someday. And I think the disease is especially cunning for those people who have suffered a relapse. And I know that the message must have weight and depth. So, the other weekend I was at the airport and I heard in my head, it's a long road back from the brink of self-annihilation. I am in my, I'm 12 years sober, and that sentence is very true, and I don't know where it came from, it just popped into my head. So for me, the brink of self-annihilation, I got there, it looked great in the beginning. For me, in the beginning, alcohol was a big-time solution. I started drinking alcoholically in college. Alcohol in the school that I went to was, it was one of the top 10 party schools in the country. I didn't know this when I applied, and I was thrilled about it by the time I graduated. So there'd been a change already in my attitude toward alcohol. I remember in high school thinking that the people who partied were losers, burnouts, we called them. And by the time I graduated from college, I knew that they knew how to live, and I was one of them. I had arrived. I particularly, my drinking really took off the summer. I grew up, I was born and raised in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and I went to school in Syracuse. And the summer that the casinos opened, I got a job in a cocktail lounge. So you can imagine me in my black hot pants and my earth shoes. Budding lesbian that I was, I didn't get it that the high heels were sort of de rigueur. And I was a terrible cocktail waitress because I was drunk. But I made a lot of money. I made an awful lot of money. You know, and it reminds me of that part in Bill's story where he talks about the loud talk in the jazz clubs. I mean, it was really a great summer. I had an amazing time. But it was the first time I began to wonder about my drinking. I asked my fellow cocktail waitress, I said, how do you know when you have a drinking problem? And she said, when you drink in the morning. This was probably at about 5 a.m., mind you. Because the club closed at 6. I said, oh, I never drink in the morning. But I was asleep till 4, so of course I didn't drink in the quote-unquote morning. I mean, it was by the time I got up, it was already cocktail hour. And in those days, frankly, it was fun. And that was my first experience of blackouts. Somehow I knew what they were, although I don't know why or how. I remember that I drove home from this particular club. It was a drive of about, I don't know, 3/4 of a mile or so. But I would wake up in the morning and think, oh, my God. I would have no memory of anything beyond, like, whatever, 4 a.m., you know, maybe not even remember cashing out. Thank you. My sponsor also said to get sober in 5 minutes, so I'm going to speed up. What happened was, after college, I moved to New York, I got a job in publishing, and I came out. And when I came out, the gloves came off. Now I'm getting emotionally involved with people, women, and I began to work on what would become my first 8-step list. I had a ton of inappropriate relationships. And I was proud of this. It was another one of those crazy upside-down alcoholic thinking things that I thought that if people said things about me like, don't leave your mother alone in the room with Marita, don't leave your girlfriend alone in the room with Marita, I thought that was like a badge of honor or something, that this made me cool. It made me very sick, actually. It proved that I, you know, alcohol had already completely deprived me of any morals, whichever morals I had come in with. And, you know, frankly, I mean, I'm not a goody-two-shoes. Sober, even, I'm not a goody-two-shoes. And, you know, if it was just morality, I really wouldn't care. But the problem is this behavior was making me very depressed. It was making me feel really lousy about myself, only I didn't know it. And the problem with alcoholism, it tied my thinking into such a knot that this insane behavior that was making me so miserable, the more I drank, the more insane my behavior became, the more affairs I had, that, you know, the next pretty girl was going to fix it, you know, was going to make me not feel so incredibly ugly and have such terrible, deep self-loathing. My first sponsor said to me that, for me, low self-esteem would be an improvement. And she was on the money on that. I remember I worked in a building at the time I got sober that had a mirrored, like, the steel on the inside of the elevator doors was, in effect, a mirror. It was so shiny. And mirrors were my mortal enemy, especially if there were other women around. I loathed my face. I mean, it used to just, I died 1,000 deaths if I was on the elevator and someone spoke to me, because then you had to look in the mirror. And seeing my face next to the face of any other woman, I really did think I had a deformed face. And that was my alcoholism. It had really taken me to such an abyss. When my first 4th step, I called this one section the body parts section. Like, I hated the hair on my arms. I hated, what else did I have? My thighs, my flabby thighs. I mean, I really had to inventory my body because I was resentful of every part of me, every inch of me. So what happened was the drinking, you know, I guess it ceased to be a luxury. It ceased to be a party. It turned into a fatal progression, and I didn't know it. The thoughts of suicide that had been fleeting in high school became more and more frequent. This lifestyle that I was living had deprived me of any kind of moral compass. And, you know, it talks about alcohol shutting us off from the sunlight of the spirit, and even if you don't believe in God, which I certainly didn't during those years, there is a feeling of joy in life. And I could tell that there was something wrong with me. I knew that there was something wrong with me. I knew that I was missing something that other people had. That it was as if people had a shell or something that protected them from pain, and I didn't have it. Or that there was some key missing ingredient. I remember identifying with things like the Land of the Misfit Toys and that stupid Rudolph thing they showed at Christmas. And I just knew there was something. It was something fatally broken about me. And like Bill, I thought that I was going to end up either in a mental institution or I was going to commit suicide. It was just a question of which unpleasant ending would my life have, and, you know, how long would I be able to hold on until I met that end. And you know, like, this previous speakers were fabulous, and, you know, this whole thing about, you know, this is the night. This is the night when everything's going to change. My luck is going to change. Something magical is going to happen. And then it would always be that, the terrible, incomprehensible demoralization. I remember this one time I went out clubbing in Margate, which is near Atlantic City, with some other young women, and I got very drunk, and I went to a bungalow with a couple of guys, and I was not out yet, and I'd gone into a blackout, I still don't know really what happened that night, and I was terrified. I didn't know how much time had passed, I didn't know how I had gotten here, I didn't know where I was relative to the bar, and I was worried about whether my friends had gone home with the only vehicle, and I got back to the bar, and they were all like, "Where were you? We were so worried." And the worst thing was the next day, because I had one of those hangovers, that horrible kind of hangover where you cannot get up except to go to the couch or to the bathroom rather than back to the couch or the bed. And I spent the whole day laying there with the tape playing of the night before over and over in my head, and that horrible sense of impending doom that Bill describes more eloquently than I can. So in November 1996, I was acting out again in relationships. I was living with a woman, but I was not committed, although I had committed myself. We'd had a commitment ceremony, and I was already philandering, and we had a woman that I had had an affair with as a tenant in the house. It was truly insane. And when I would tell the women in AA about my dramas, they couldn't keep the names of these women straight, and I thought the problem was their problem. It was me. My life was that insane and unmanageable. So I got a sponsor. I don't know why. I forgot the part where I come to AA. One of the women I was having the affair with was in AA. So God hid the message in the only place this woman would ever find it. He hid it in another woman. And I woke up one morning, and it's one of those funny things. It's clear as a bell. That night, that morning is as clear as the light in this room. I remember where I was, and I remember how miserable I was. And then I remember saying, "Will you take me to that high noon meeting?" It was a Sunday, obviously, if you know the meeting. And I don't know what put those words in my mouth. I have no idea. There was no forethought or whatever. And I heard a speaker once say that there's a moment in everyone's story where the record skips. And that's the moment when the higher power enters the picture. And the person often doesn't know why they did thus and such. So that's the moment where I don't know why I did this thing. But I went to the meeting, and I sobbed through the entire qualification. And something felt better. I felt a moment of, I felt a feeling in that room of hope. I felt a feeling of, I know now that what I felt really was a higher power. I felt a spirituality. I remember describing it at the time as like a feeling of something in this room maybe could heal me. Maybe this time there was something that could actually fix whatever was so broken in me. The problem was I wasn't an alcoholic. So I didn't know how that was going to work. So for the following 3 or 4 days, I tried to hold on and go back in my mind to the feeling of sitting in that meeting, and it petered out after a few days. And the night before Thanksgiving, I drank again. But this time, when I took the drink, I looked at it, and a voice in my head said, "Maybe this is the problem." And that, I know, is the voice that speaks to me today. That's the good voice. And the following day, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was November 28, 1996, and it was Thanksgiving, and I always say that God was very good to help me to remember that this is about being grateful, because I can be a real whiner, as my sponsor could tell you. That's not my stage character, the one I like you to see, but that's true. I am a whiner. So I started working the steps out of the Hazelton workbooks, which are these things that they sold at the meeting I went to. I don't recommend this, but this is what my sponsor told me to do, so this is what I did. A year later, I was getting really uncomfortable. We still hadn't done my third step, and I was climbing out of my skin. I had quit smoking, and I was ready to kill somebody. And being the person that I was, I, of course, at 6 months sober, got into a relationship, because that's what I did. I don't recommend that either, but, you know, I didn't drink over it, and I learned a lot, and the ninth step can do a lot of good when you do these things. So I went through, at that point, I got a new sponsor. She took me through the fourth step. I did it, thank God, out of the columns and not as that other sponsor was going to have me do the Hazelton workbook. But I did the four columns, and I did my fifth step in a truly insane manner. I remember we sat in a Europa cafe because I was so obsessed with this relationship that I didn't want to make myself unavailable on an evening or, God forbid, a weekend afternoon. I refused to go to my sponsor's apartment. all the way out in Brooklyn. And so I made her sit with me in a Europa cafe, and I did my fifth step, you know. I was done flat, so I was blah, 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 blah. I mean, I said it like an auctioneer, like, blah, 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 blah. You know, I just remember her sitting across from me in the, amid the din, like this, trying to hear, you know, what I was saying. And I guess that was fear of, you know, really being honest. And when Thea took me through the steps again, when we did the fourth step, she said this really wonderful thing. She said, be terse, but not too terse. And I had already figured out by this time that that first fourth step, I mean, I didn't, you know, Bill's story, in the examples in the columns, it says, you know, I'm resentful at Mr. Brown, his attentions to my wife. It doesn't go into this whole long drama about, oh, we went to this 4th of July barbecue, and the minute we walked in the door, Mr. Brown was staring at her, and every time I turned around, you know, that was my first 4th step. So three sittings at Europa later, this poor woman, we couldn't finish even then, and I finished it over the telephone that night, and she said, okay, now take that hour, and she described the hour to me, and I said, oh, okay, and I went down and watched television. So I had a sort of a conditional surrender in these days, and at this time I was about 2 years sober, thank you, and this is what happened. So then we didn't do any other inventories, and were my home group at the time, nobody was talking about any fear inventories or any sex inventories. There was just, I remember hearing about a sex inventory, like, vaguely. Imagine that, me. I didn't hear anything about this. I probably heard it, and I just, you know, turned the ear off. And I figured, oh, well, you know, the girlfriends were in there. It's kind of all part and parcel of whatever that was. And I wasn't going to any big book meetings. And the big book was kind of a dirty word. I mean, people used to say things like big book Nazi. I mean, what an awful turn of phrase when you think about it. But that's what people were saying in the meetings I was going to in the late 90s. And, that was the late 90s. So we went forward, we lurched forward, and I really don't know what we did about 6 and 7. I have no recollection of it, but I made an 8-step list, and by that time, this is kind of interesting, my sponsor had changed sponsors, and her new sponsor was this woman named Thea. That Thea, my Thea. So I loved Thea. I had met her. She was coming to my then home group at the time at lunchtime, as well as coming here, and she had a very powerful message. In fact, I heard Thea when I was a year sober, and boy, wow. She's a beacon, man. That woman, there were things she said when I was a year sober that I still remember, and I have trouble remembering things that somebody said to me yesterday. But she said, for example, that if you were, she chaired the beginners meeting at one point, and I was a newcomer, and she said, if you're having trouble deciding what to do, you know, you don't know whether to make the call or not make the call, for example, she said, and if it's too late to call your sponsor for whatever reason, and you just need to figure this out on your own, she said, ask yourself one question, which is the harder thing to do? And then she said, and then do that, because it's probably right. And if not, at least you'll grow. And, you know, she just had this, like, this light about her and this wisdom that drew me like a moth to a flame. But I was a chicken. And I knew she was a big book sponsor. And then I came here to hear Clancy one time, and I said, oh, wow, these people are really heavy duty. Great message, but just way too intense. Can't take that, you know. And so that even scared me more, and I spent years kind of watching Thea, but not asking her to be my sponsor. But at the time I was doing my 8th and 9th step, she was sponsoring my sponsor. So I did the 9th step the way Thea had me do it. And Thea had given her this script. And I was like, script? I'm not talking like that. Nobody talks like that in the real world. They'll all think I'm uncool. You know, I'm still obsessed with being cool. While doing my 9th step, you know how people are just sitting out there thinking, gosh, she's doing this immense. I hope she's cool. Crazy. So I did my little flip remarks, one time too many, you know, playing games, and a 9th step exploded in my face. I don't want to bore you with all the details, but it was a woman in the, I'm also in the gay marching band during all of this, before, during, and now after, and this woman was also in the band. So for years, I had every week a woman who wouldn't look me in the eye and just oozed hate at me, and people would come up to me and say, why is she so mad at you? And I was like, you know, I'm not going to say, well, I botched my 9th step, you know. But it was a constant reminder of, you know, when all else fails, follow directions. Which, incidentally, if you're having trouble following directions, my own personal opinion and based on my experience is sometimes the only way, well, not sometimes, the only way I can follow directions is first, I have to do the first part of that instruction, which is, try all else. I really will try all else before I'll follow directions. And this is what the early sobriety, these early years are about, me trying all else, because I thought, you know, Who wants that steeper path like Thea and these AG people have? I'm going to try this. This, you know, round and round the mountain is just as good as this straight up thing. You know, what's the rush? So I'll tell you my take on that too is, you know, if the mountain has a quicksand patch and you decide to go round and round, you're going to spend like a year in the quicksand as opposed to whoop. You know, so there's a good reason for the steeper path, and I personally believe it's the easier, softer way. But that's because I've already tried all else. So you might have to finish your all else thing first. I'm just going to move this slightly. Okay, so my 9 step. So I botched that one, and then I got it that this script was really like a rope when you're in a raging river. Like, I don't need this rope. No, I do need this rope, and this is my way across the raging river. 9 steps are, they're dynamite, and I often find myself saying, using that analogy with sponsees, like, well, okay, so you know nothing about demolitions, and you've got a demolitions expert here on the phone. You want to try to figure this out for yourself, or you want some advice? You know, I mean, this is really what it is. 9 steps are dynamite. In a good way, too, like the 9 steps where if they're on, thereafter I followed the script. And, you know, it was a lot of the women that I had engaged in, you know, really inappropriate behavior with and had really hurt. I had hurt a lot of people. You know, sweet relationships are dead, hearts are broken. By the time I got to those amends, I was now 7 years sober, because what happened when I did exactly what it talks about, where you do a couple, like the easier ones, and then you just zzz, to a halt. And the 9 step, which at the time was on index cards, sat in my nightstand for many, many years. And I do mean many years, was 4 years. And every night and every morning, it pressured me. And I did nothing about it because I was trying all else. I had gone, I did have some things happen. I did have cancer. I'm a cancer survivor. I had endometrial cancer when I was 4 years sober. And with thanks to the strength of the rooms and my higher power, I got through it. And then I said, see you later, to God. So in my 5th year, I had no God. I had seen his works, and I was mad at him, really. I was mad. I was mad at God. But, you know, he doesn't hurry. I always say he doesn't hurry. This is not mine either. He doesn't hurry, but he's never late. In November of that year, I think it was November, this relationship I'd gotten into in early sobriety was imploding. And I had no God, and my sponsor suggested, meanwhile I'm on another sponsor, there's about 3 more sponsors have gone and come and gone during this time, because that was part of my story too, change sponsors and dance. So this sponsor said to me, Marita, why don't you try writing a letter? So I wrote a letter to God that morning, and that night my girlfriend broke up with me, and I kind of had a free fall, because if you're 5.5 years sober, or 6 years sober, and you've been in a relationship for 5.5 of those years, your sobriety kind of winds around the relationship a bit, like a vine. And so I really felt destabilized and very uncertain, because, you know, at that point I still made women and people that I loved, I made them my higher power. I didn't know this at the time, but I can see it now. And so what happened was I had written to God that morning. So as she was packing, which it took her 4 hours to do, and moving out of my apartment, my house that night, I just sat at my kitchen table and I just wrote to God. And it was really freaky, you know, that it's so incredible, isn't it? A whole year of no God. And that morning I wrote to him, and that night he was there. I don't know what would have happened to me if I hadn't had God, you know, if I hadn't had God to talk to during that time. So this began yet another chapter in my sobriety. And at this time, free to go to things. I was always drawn to things like big book studies, but I didn't want to upset my girlfriend who was in the program. And she didn't like any of that stuff, and so I didn't go. So I went to the Atlantic Group Big Book Study, and this was the first time I was ever really at a big book study, and I'm 6 years sober. I think that one of the great things that's happening in AA today is even that home group that I told you about now has a big book study. I didn't even bring it up. I wanted to, but I didn't. Someone else brought up, let's add a big book meeting, and now we do have a big book meeting. And I and one of my sponsees are one of the co-chairs, and I'm like, wow, this is a miracle. They have a big book meeting. At any rate, I went to the Atlantic Group Big Book Study, and Heidi was one of the speakers, and I knew Heidi, too, from this other meeting I keep referring to, and I loved Heidi, and Heidi shared and talked about a fear inventory and a sex inventory, and I was like, I still didn't hear the fear one. I was like, sex inventory? I didn't do a sex inventory, and she described it, and I looked in the book, and yeah, really, it's right there, right, black and white, whole paragraph. Okay, news to me. So I talked to Heidi about it afterwards, and I asked her if she would hear my inventory, and she said she would. So notice I'm not working with my sponsor, but whatever. I was sponsoring myself. I always had a sponsor, but the real sponsor was Marita during this time. I can tell you, and Thea, I know you're going to listen to this someday, that is no longer the case. Thea is my sponsor. At any rate, I went back to the hotel that night in Vermont, and I wrote the list, and then I got involved with a 27-year-old. I swear, the next day. The next day. So that was by list, bye-bye, hello, 27-year-old. So still the same old sober horse thief. But, you know, God was God made this the last or all else for me so far. And what happened, I left one thing out. I'm an only child, and my mother and I were very, very close. And that spring, shortly before the Big Book study, in fact, my mother had passed away. And my biggest living amends was to my mother. Because, like, that night that I went out to the club and I told you I was, you know, all I could do was go from the couch to the toilet. I was at my mother's house. You know, my mother was 42 when she had me, so by this time she would have been, say, 70. So here's this poor 70-year-old woman whose daughter's staying out till all hours partying, and I'm, you know, then spending the day hungover on her couch and crying and talking about suicide. So my mother died of Alzheimer's, and she died in my arms. And you know that no drinking alcoholic would have been there for any of that, and certainly would not have been there at the end. And I did for her what she used to do for me when she was nursing me when I was very sick, and I was sick from this disease more so than anything else in my life. And I held her, and I sang to her. And I talked to her, and I told her I loved her. And I felt this incredible, I don't talk about this too much, but it sounds kind of wacky, but the truth is, I felt that there was something right on the other side of her which she could see that I could not. And I said, I had this overwhelming sense that I was handing this woman off to the God that had put her in my life. And it was right there, only I couldn't see it, but I could sense it. I could feel it. And my mother was a dancer. She was actually a chorus line dancer in burlesque days. Not the hoochie-coochie kind, but the clean kind. I mean it. She was clean. I swear. I have pictures. But anyway, and the moment after her breathing stopped, it was so subtle. And then I saw it in my mind. Like I saw this movie in my mind, and my mother was dancing towards this light in my mind. And she was young again. I don't know, you know, this stuff never happened to me when I drank. I don't know, I hallucinated, but nothing like this. And you know what it is? It's not about the stupid thing I saw. It's about what I felt. And it's about the sense of self-esteem that I feel for being there in that time. So anyway, finally, after 2 months of this 27-year-old romp, the 27-year-old dumps me because she's smarter than I am, and I go crawling back to Heidi, and boy, did I write up. I wrote up my sex inventory, finally. And I remember going to Heidi's apartment that day and reading, and going home. And I literally felt like I'd had surgery and had everything removed. I don't know how to explain it any other way than that. And shortly thereafter, I was desperate my life was falling apart because of this new bottom I'd hit in sobriety, and I was 7 years sober. And I heard a man say that if you're between 5 and 10 years sober, now, I wouldn't even give it that much time, but whatever. And you haven't finished your ninth step yet. You're in the graveyard, and that's when a lot of people drink. You haven't finished the inventory, meaning the four through seven and your ninth step. So I got scared because I had these cards sitting there, and I put pedal to the metal, and I finished my ninth step. And the day I finished the final ninth step, I had this very strange experience. I was looking for, you know, some kind of, you know, spiritual gimme, like give me a little rocket fuel, give me a little high feeling, you know, something like that. And instead, I ended up sobbing on the floor of my shower, and I crawled out of there. Literally, I felt like I was having a breakdown, and I called Thea, this friend of mine, Thea, and I told her what had happened, and she said, yes, yes. And now, I couldn't have called anyone else in that moment, snotty cry, naked on the floor, you know, ugh, and tell someone what's really happening, you know. And she said, yes, yes, yes. And what had happened was the scales had fallen from my eyes, and I had seen exactly who I had been all these years, how all this romantic acting out, what it was all about, you know, yes, making women my higher power, you know, seeing a pretty face, plastering a personality onto it of my imagining, and then having a relationship with this person, even before I said, hello, what's your name? You know, just crazy, crazy behavior. And that was the end of that. It was the turning point in my sobriety. And you know, as long as you're putting other things in front of God, you can't have God. So that was the beginning of really God's entrance into my life. And now I'm not a holy roller. I often forget when I speak to talk about God. And I sit down and I say, "Oh no, I never mentioned God." But see, for me, thank you. Thank you. God is everything. I mean, my love for my sober sister Liz is a God thing. You know, I just to tell you where I'm at. I have 1 minute. I'm going to tell you where I'm at today. This year, the past 365 days, my partner, who is a citizen of the country of Mexico, got approved for her green card. We were married about 3 weeks ago. Was it 3 weeks? 3 weeks ago in my backyard. Was it 3 weeks? Thank you. Yeah, right? And it is a sober relationship. She is a normal person, and you know, we have a lovely home and a lovely life, and it's really quiet. There's none of that stuff that I thought was really what the dreams were made of and really was made of nightmares. My sponsor, Thea, flew here. She tried to come and speak, but that was not meant to be. But she was there for me, and my sober sisters were at the wedding, and I marched to the inaugural parade with that band. I mean, it's just been a weird year. It's been an amazing year, and it's been a weird year. And I think the greatest honor is the one I've just enjoyed. Thank you.